Well, it is probably going to take you less than a sentence to hear that I have lost my voice. I was hit with a bad cold about 2 days ago, and throughout this morning, it's gone right to my voice. So if you're, I would back up from your radio or whatever device you're listening on to Two-Way Street today, because I don't want you to get what I've got. Nevertheless, we're going to soldier through today's show. Fortunately, our conversation with Ken Burns was recorded before I got this terrible cold, so you won't have to listen to me talk this way. Fortunately, I don't have to say much about Ken Burns in setting up this conversation. You know him as one of the greatest documentary filmmakers in the country. His documentary series on the Civil War back in 1990 was the highest rated show on PBS back then. But his career goes back far before then. In 1981, he won an Academy Award nomination for a documentary on the Brooklyn Bridge. Much more recently, you probably saw his documentary on the Roosevelts, on baseball, on jazz. Ken Burns is one movie at a time telling us about who we are as Americans. And now Vietnam, one of the most complex stories, as you'll hear him discuss, that he's ever told, is about to get started on PBS. So let's listen to my conversation with Ken Burns. Ken Burns, welcome to Two-Way Street. It's really a pleasure to get a chance to talk to you about your new film, The Vietnam War. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
So you were born, I think, in 1953, which means that you were coming of age in the heart of Vietnam, and you grew up on at least a couple of college campuses, including the University of Michigan. What was it like for you coming up as a teenager during Vietnam? How did you experience the war from your perspective as a young person here in the United States?
Well, I did grow up on two college campuses, the University of Delaware from 1955 until 1963, 2 to 10, and then from 10 to 18 in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the campus of the University of Michigan, the main campus there. It was very much a part of my life. We were all Vietnam all the time, it seemed. I came of age probably, you know, with the Kennedy-Nixon election of 1960, but really it was the Cuban Missile Crisis in the fall of my fourth grade in Delaware. But by the time I'd reached Ann Arbor, I was fully aware of what was going on in the world and the news and read the paper every day. And Ann Arbor was a hotbed of anti-war activity. One of the first, if not the first, teach-in occurred at the University of Michigan. And one of the organizing departments was the anthropology department, where my father was. And so I remember very well all of that and the subsequent sort of lifestyle and protest things that took place. And of course, because I am born in 1953, I was eligible for the draft and registered and was anxious about what my draft number would be, and ended up, by the time that that happened, Nixon was withdrawing, and the draft as a kind of fundamental force in the lives of young men had ended. And so, Vietnam was very much a part of my consciousness for at least as long as most people remember it.
You said it was all Vietnam all the time. I'm just a little bit older than you are, but if your campus at University of Michigan, not that you were a student there, but you lived there, if University of Michigan was like my school, classes were secondary. What really mattered was a gathering, in my case, at the Student Union Building, and the anti-war and the pro-war people spending each day arguing about the war vociferously and never getting anywhere in those conversations.
Sound familiar? I believe that one of the reasons that I hope the film has a broad impact, or the hope that it has a broad impact, is that it might be able to change the dynamics of the dialogue we have right now, if that's what you can charitably call it, into something that's civil and civic, that we could probably do some unpacking of the Vietnam War and have a conversation with us. We were very conscious of an attempt to permit what always happens in war, but for multiple points of view, for multiple truths to be have find a safe place. And so you'll see lots of perspectives in this film without any kind of thumb on the scale or agenda on our part. We would just want to be umpires calling balls and strikes. Now, I did not go to the University of Michigan. I was really aware of it, but I went away to college where it was, you know, a small, tiny college, and by then, you know, I think 100% of the student body was against the war by the time I got there. But I am aware by osmosis of what was taking place in Ann Arbor with very, very bitter conversations and demonstrations and near riots that took place in the intervening years since that first teach-in happened in March of 1965, just as we had put boots on the ground, combat troops, not just advisors.
Your mother was sick for most of the time that you were little. You've actually said your mother was that's what your memory is of her, that she was always sick. She passed away when you were 11. And you have quoted in a number of conversations your father telling you what about the work that you do today in relation to your mom.
Well, it's true. My mother got cancer sometime around 1955 when I was two. And I don't remember a moment when there wasn't this just horrific sort of Damocles hanging over our family. That ended. We moved to Ann Arbor. My father had another job choice, but we chose Ann Arbor in large measure because it had not only was it a great institution, but it had a university hospital that could treat my mother. But the month after that first teach-in happened in April of 1965, my mother passed away. And I had many years later a conversation, not with my father, but with my father-in-law, who's also now passed away as well, who I told him that I seemed unable to remember the date in April that she had died. The date was sort of coming up towards me and then receding, but I was never present during the day. And he said, well, I bet you blew out your birthday candles into adulthood wishing she'd come back alive. And I say, how do you know? And he says, you've got the magical thinking of an 11-year-old. That's what you do for a living. He said, what do you think you do for a living? And I said, what do you mean? He says, you wake the dead. You make, you know, Abraham Lincoln and Jackie Robinson come alive. Who do you think you're really trying to wake up?
Yeah, you've quoted your father-in-law at one point. What you recall is he said, he told me that my whole work was an attempt to make people long gone come back alive. And of course, through films like the Civil War and so much of your other work, that's precisely true. So let's talk about the Vietnam War, if we can. You've said that this film, and you said you kind of hesitate to call it this, is sort of like a Russian novel. What do you mean by that?
Well, the adjective Russian, not the noun, or maybe the noun too, are not sort of popular these days. But an epic Russian novel of the kind that Leo Tolstoy might write, like War and Peace, is a huge epic ranging across many, many years and at various levels and strata of society with many different characters that you're introduced to, both big and central and also small and cameo, but all very interesting and finely drawn. And so when you realize that you've spent 10 years working with an extraordinary team of people on this film and that you're juggling 79 people that you get to know, some of them intensely through almost every episode of the film, others that come and make an appearance but once in the film or twice, and you're telling many, many other stories, including many other individuals now dead, historical stories of presidents from Wilson to Truman to Eisenhower to Kennedy to Johnson to Nixon to Ford, you realize that you've got a big epic story in that way, and that what you're juggling is one huge narrative, but also many subsidiary narratives.
You've worked on this picture, and you just described to some extent the scope, which is overwhelming. It's been more than 10 years or so in the making. And you've said that you feel like now is finally the time when we can deal with Vietnam, or now is the time we can look at it in a more
honest and accurate light. And I was interested in that because I think back, there was a complaint, as you know, into the 80s, actually, that filmmakers were dealing with Vietnam, that they were afraid to touch it, that it was a third rail. But then we had films like Platoon and Full Metal Jacket, Casualties of War, Born on the 4th of July, that did, in fact, deal with Vietnam. So why?
And Deer Hunter, Apocalypse Now, all of them following hard on the heels of the fall of Saigon. So I sort of reject that argument.
So that's what I wanted to ask you. What has this country not yet digested or dealt with about Vietnam that you hope you are going to begin a conversation to some resolution on?
Almost everything. Everything we know from Vietnam probably comes from the made-up fiction of those films. And in classic fashion, the American films about the Vietnam War have, curiously enough, focused only on Americans. And the enemy are nameless, faceless hordes. And our allies, the country for which we sacrificed more than 58,000 lives, that country disappeared. And its soldiers and its citizens have been dispersed around the world, including the United States. And we felt it was super important to have a film about the Vietnam War, which we think is the most important event in American history since the Second World War, we'd better understand it. This is a war we essentially lost, or at least ended, as we say in the film, in failure. And Americans don't like to talk about that, so we kind of buried our head. We opened the film with a Marine testifying that he and his wife were friends with another couple for 12 years, and the two wives were talking, and they discovered that they'd both been Marines in Vietnam. Nobody had said a word about it. And he said, it's like living in a family with an alcoholic father. Shh, we don't talk about that.
As usual in a Ken Burns film, you have found portraits, you found individuals whose life stories are so compelling to us. And when you talk about the fact that we've always heard about the war from the American perspective, I think about some of the Vietnamese who were on the side of the North. One of them, I think, is particularly moving. She's now a much older woman, but she, as a young Vietnamese girl, and I'm sorry, I don't remember her name, she went south with schoolmates of hers. Their job was to help keep the Ho Chi Minh Trail clear. And she took with her books, American writers. She was a lover of American literature. And as she was out with her schoolmates trying to keep the trail cleared for the Viet Cong, she was reading American literature.
She was reading Ernest Hemingway. Her name is Le Minh Que, and her uncle and aunt who'd raised her had always been aficionados of American literature, and so she went south to repair the Ho Chi Minh Trail, as you say, with a book by Ernest Hemingway, and said she, in fact, credits Hemingway with her being able to survive out there.
Yeah, she was reading For Whom the Bell Tolls, I think you say.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. You told one interviewer, you said each day of the production was a kind of a daily humiliation of what we didn't know. You know, I'd love to hear a couple of those things that you learned. If you don't mind, I want to start with something that really startled me, because like you, Vietnam played such a huge role in my life when I was young. I thought I knew this. I thought I knew that Ho Chi Minh was in fact the day-to-day active leader of the Viet Cong and of North Vietnam. And as I watched your film, I learned that isn't true at all.
Not quite true. Yeah, pretty interesting. I came, our writer Jeff Ward was, is in his 70s right now, and he lived through it as an adult. I'm in my 60s. I lived through it as a teenager, and Lynn is in her 50s, and she was a little girl, and Sarah Botstein, our senior producer, is in her 40s and kind of missed it, but nonetheless, we all, brought some sense that we knew something about it. And for Jeff and me particularly, we're humiliated daily by what we didn't know. Yes, Ho Chi Minh remained the face of the revolution to the world and to his people, the beloved leader. But by 1959, and that's not a typo, he was being challenged for supremacy on the Politburo by other more hardliners. And one emerges from this. And by 64, Ho has abstained on a vote to do a particularly aggressive thing, which he thinks thinks correctly will not turn out very well militarily, and he's essentially ceded his power to this individual. And I think it's very interesting that Americans who claim to know about Vietnam out on the road in the last few years as we've begun to talk about the film, I've never met, other than scholars or Vietnamese themselves, folks who know who was actually running the country. It's still, you know, it's like telling people that baseball didn't happen, it wasn't invented at Cooperstown. They go, yep, and I'm now taking my kid to Cooperstown, which is a great place to go, but it's not where baseball was invented.
You know what else is interesting to me about that is that, as you describe Ho Chi Minh's somewhat diminished role to what we thought it was, he was not the hardliner. And I suppose you could make the case that both Ho Chi Minh and Lyndon Johnson, who you have a recorded phone call with Johnson talking to Richard Russell, the great senator from right here in Georgia, saying there ain't no daylight in Vietnam.
Right.
What do you think about this Vietnam thing? Frankly, Mr. President, if you were to tell me that I was authorized to settle it as I saw fit, I would respectfully decline to undertake it. It's the damn worst mess I ever saw, and I don't like to brag. I never have been right many times in my life, but I knew we were going to get in this sort of mess when we went in there, and I don't see how we're going to ever get out.
And what occurs to me is that, in some ways, both Lyndon Johnson and Ho Chi Minh were not eager to have this massive confrontation and this terrible war take place, and yet it did anyway.
That's exactly right. And there's layers and layers of tragedy in any war. And Vietnam, unlike the two other wars that I've done, the Civil War and the Second World War, which seem to have relatively unambiguous endings, you know, uniting the nation, freeing the slaves, or ridding the world of fascism, though the current events of these days don't necessarily suggest that either war is over, then, you know, Vietnam has no such thing attached to it. But what's so interesting is the many different paths we could have taken, including, as we did in 1945, where the OSS parachuted into northern Vietnam and saved the life of Ho Chi Minh and then went on to arm his revolutionary army, yeah, then called the Viet Minh, to fight the Japanese. And, you know, there, but for the grace of God, Ho Chi Minh could have been our ally, but in point of fact, exterior events, the Cold War, interposed themselves between our natural inclination to support Ho, who quoted, and when he declared Vietnamese independence, Thomas Jefferson and the second sentence of the Declaration. That would have been enough with an OSS officer standing nearby. But the requirements of the Cold War meant that we had to sort of eliminate him. He became the enemy. The French wanted their colony restored after the war, and we set about helping them. And when they were defeated, we kind of inherited the notion of making a viable country out of South Vietnam, which had not existed to that day. And so, you know, lots of things overlay: Cold War miscalculation, civil war going on, a fight for independence. Lots of different opinions on that, and probably all of them are true. And this is our job here, is just to report the various happenstance, and it's very tragic, including that call to Richard Russell is very poignant because he's at the point where he's sending in the ground troops.
Yeah.
And it's an episode called The River Styx, and we're crossing it at that moment. We've had advisors, and Kennedy's, you know, increased their numbers from a few hundred to, you know, several thousand, 16,000-17,000 by the time he's assassinated. And then Johnson's, you know, spending, you know, more than a year and a quarter, almost a year and a half as president, waiting for the moment to avoid, and here he can't help but get deeper and deeper into this quagmire.
I keep quoting what I've read from other interviews because I tried to do as much research as I could to get ready for you. And I do know that one of the things you've said on a number of occasions, you've said, if I had only one story to tell, if I stripped away all the other 78 interviews I did, it would be that of John Musgrave. And then you would change the title to The Education of John Musgrave. Who is John Musgrave, and why is his story so compelling?
Well, John Musgrave is a Marine from Missouri, and he gave an interview to Lynn Novick, my co-director on this, that is just extraordinary. And what I said was accurate, that if some evil genie was going to take away all my interviews but one, I would request that one. you know, we like to, particularly today in our media culture where if it bleeds, it leads, we're into conflict. And we see these conflicts as between people, groups, tribes, countries, whatever it might be. But the conflicts within ourselves are really the most interesting. They're the ones that William Shakespeare was curious about, that all of those who pretend to art understand that's the real nub. This is, of course, of war, and that's between countries and between groups of people, and it has all of its ferocity. But quite often, the interior development of human beings is interesting. And so we follow John Musgrave's life. That's all I really want to say. He was a very, yep. very brave Marine. And he served his country well in many, many ways. And I just found his understanding of things and his willingness to speak a kind of brutal honesty about what he saw and what he experienced and about his own conduct so amazing that he became, I think, a hero of everyone in the editing room. And while he is, you know, he's not the dominant interview in the film by far, he's just one of many very interesting ones. I think people will attach themselves to the arc of his story and the fact that today he counsels veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan and does so selflessly, hoping to, you know, intervene in their own personal demons and the struggles of PTSD that many of them, like him, suffered from.
Yeah, his story is compelling, and viewers will watch it play out over the course of your film. But here's one of the reasons that I thought Musgrave, as I thought about him, was really interesting. He told a Vanity Fair magazine that he's still scared of those guys, meaning North Vietnamese soldiers. And he says, I'm scared of the ones who are the age that they were back then, the ones who are in my nightmares. And yet, when he sees the North Vietnamese, the old-timers now who appear in your film, he suddenly says, I'd consider it an honor to sit down with them and talk, rifleman to rifleman. They were hellaciously good soldiers. I just wish they hadn't been so good. That alone is such a tribute to what you've put together in this picture. That's very moving.
It's so moving, and you just think about, you know, there's no danger that human beings are ever going to stop going to war, I'm very sorry to say. It brings out the very worst of us, and John is a very honest and very descriptive and very brutal commentator on what war does. But it also brings out the very best, and he's one of the very best I've ever, you know, had the occasion to get to know. And I think that we have to understand that as sort of fundamentally human an activity going to war is, it's also horrible to come home from war and not know what to do with the experiences you've had, the stuff that no one else can understand. And these are all guys in their late 60s or early 70s, American and Vietnamese. And they tell a very, very similar story of fear, of anger, of hatred, and of the difficulty of letting go of these experiences once they come home.
You've owned this picture for 10-plus years, you and Lynn Novick and your other people on your team. And now it's owned by the public.
Yeah.
That must be a really interesting feeling.
Well, it's very bittersweet. It's like sending your kid off to college, which I've done now twice with two to go. And it's tough. They're going to be part of your life, but they're going to be a different person from now on, and they're going to live their own life and have their own trajectory. And there's something very, very bittersweet. But I'll tell you one thing. The second a film is done, it doesn't belong to Lynn and me or the others in our crew. It belongs to everybody else.
If you've just joined us for Two-Way Street, my guest today is Ken Burns. He has a new documentary series on the Vietnam War that starts on PBS on Sunday evening. Let's get back to that conversation. You spoke at the Vanderbilt commencement in May, and among the many things you've said, you said that your own life's work has been an attempt to reveal those better angels to my neighbor, my fellow citizens, to you. And of course, you're talking about Abraham Lincoln's quote, which you included certainly in the Civil War, appealing to the better angels of our nature. That's a wonderful summary of your work, to appeal to the better angels of our nature. Does the Vietnam War fit into that, Ken?
Well, that would be the highest compliment that anyone could ever pay me. It's Lincoln's last sentence of his first inauguration, mm-hmm. when he is pleading, we must not be enemies, we must be friends. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. He's pleading to the mostly Southerners in the audience at his first inauguration. And then he says this amazing thing, referring to the shared revolutionary past that those in the South still shared with their Northern brethren. He said, the mystic chords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. I don't know of any film, Vietnam included, that isn't in some feeble attempt on my part a way to be about unum, you know, our Latin motto, e pluribus unum, out of many one. And we suffer today, as the historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. said, late historian, that we suffer today from too much pluribus and not enough unum. Mm-hmm. I've been my entire life in the business of unum, and if the Vietnam War contributes to that, then that will be the best review it has.
Well, I've been fortunate enough to have gotten to watch the entire 18 hours, and it strikes me that having a filmmaker who wants to appeal to the better angels of our nature with this picture is doing us all a favor. The country could use that right now.
It could indeed, and I hope we can contribute that.
Ken Burns, thank you so very much for talking to us, and thank you for this remarkable film.
Thank you very much for having me, Bill.
Ken Burns' 18-hour, 10-part documentary series on the Vietnam War starts on Sunday night here on PBS GPB television. Again, I really want to apologize to all of you. My voice kind of went out over the last few hours, and we had to do the show. So I hope you'll bear with me as I try to talk to you about what I think are some very moving moments that come out of the documentary. For instance, you heard Ken talk about John Musgrave. John Musgrave was a Marine. He grew up outside of Kansas City. He was a former member of the 1st Battalion of the 9th Marines. His infantry unit took such heavy casualties that it became known as the Walking Dead. He was serving in Vietnam for about 11 months when he was shot three times and almost died. He survived. He went through rehabilitation. And he came back to the States, where he has worked ever since to try to help other veterans who are struggling with what they face, not just in Vietnam, but coming home from the wars since then. But John Musgrave is also a poet. And we found one of his poems, a poem that I'm going to say very little about because you should just let him describe it. You'll hear him describe what the poem is, what it's called, and why it's so important to him. Here's John Musgrave.
I would like to tell you that I was man enough to write this poem when I came home, but I wasn't. It took me 35 years to reach this point. It's entitled Notes to the Man Who Shot Me. When the ambush was sprung, everything became chaos. Leonard was standing beside me when he was shot. He fell to the ground like a puppet with his strings cut. I had one quick glance at you as you appeared in the foliage. The main thing I saw was that you carried an RPD light machine gun. The next moment I saw you drop to the ground near Leonard's body. Everything happened so fast. You were only a few feet away. I knew I needed to kill you before you could get that gun in action against my buddies. I took maybe two steps, shooting as I moved, but I missed. And I took a round from your first burst. My buddies were yelling to me in the midst of this madness to see if I was still alive. You were a veteran. You knew that Marines never leave their wounded. And that's when I became your bait. You waited until my first buddy reached my side and lifted me in his arms before you fired that second burst into my chest. Do you remember how the impact of those bullets tore me screaming from his arms? Then you killed him. You held your fire, knowing that my brothers would keep coming, and waited until my next buddy reached my side. You killed him, too. You were killed then, and I was rescued. I have often thought of you these 35 years. Would you be surprised to know that for all this time, I have felt like your accomplice in the killing of my friends? I hated you for years for using me as bait. But the truth is, had our roles been reversed, I would have done the same. I wish now that I could speak to you. I wonder how I look to you. I wonder, were you as terrified as I was? I wonder, did you hate me as much as I hated you? I wonder how long you've been fighting your war. I wonder if you had any children. And I wonder if you had survived and we met today, would you speak to me? I sometimes imagine us meeting again and talking about that ambush while our children play together. You were a good soldier and a good machine gunner. And I've come to realize that we had more in common than we did with the men who sent us to kill each other. If I could, I would give you the gift I have longed for all these years. The gift of peace.
John Musgrave, reading his poem, Notes to the Soldier Who Shot Me. I wish I could give you peace. Vietnam was such a fraught time for all of us who grew up in that generation. We were so troubled. We were so unsure of where the country was going. It seemed to be unraveling all around us. We didn't understand the war and the carnage that was being inflicted on the Vietnamese as well as on Americans. And the time was reflected brilliantly in the music of the day. And as I watched Ken Burns' documentary, it reminded me of some of the great music from that period of time. And one of the songs, there were anti-war songs and pro-war songs. And one of the songs that rallied so many people who were opposed to the war was written by Country Joe and the Fish. They wrote it actually in 1965, but it really took on a life of its own at Woodstock when 500,000 people joined them as they sang on stage this great anti-war song.
Well, come on, all of you big strong men, Uncle Sam needs your help again. Got himself in a terrible jam, way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books and pick up a gun, we're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn, the next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why, woo-hoo, all gone.
Country Joe and the Fish. There were occasional pro-war songs, although there weren't many of them. The most famous was the Ballad of the Green Beret, which interestingly was written as a tribute to a young soldier, an American soldier who died in Vietnam, who was from Hawaii. Staff Sergeant Barry Sadler wrote and sang this song, which we're going to hear Dolly Parton do.
I have many friends in the 101st Airborne and the 5th Special Forces at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. I go visit them when I can. The guys in Special Forces are usually the first ones into a war and often the last ones out. Imagine going into a hostile country, lightly armed and with just a few men. What they do is so secret, they never get the recognition they deserve. And this is one time I want them to know they're appreciated. Fighting soldiers from the sky, fearless men who jump and die, men who mean just what they say, the brave men of the Green Beret.
Dolly Parton singing the pro-war song, The Green Beret. There were African-American artists who wanted to express their feelings about the war. One of them was Nina Simone. She took a Langston Hughes poem that was about civil rights and repurposed it as an expression of her anger about Vietnam.
Mr. Backlash, just who do you think I am? You raise my taxes, freeze my wages, and send my son to Vietnam. You give me second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools? Mr. Backlash, I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blues.
And Marvin Gaye sang a song that has gone down as one of the greatest songs ever written. Out of the 60s. And he too was expressing the frustration and anger that he felt when black soldiers were coming back from Vietnam and living in such terrible conditions.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you to cry. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate.
I remember being in New York City working in a play in Off-Off Broadway Theater when word came that the Kent State Massacre, four students shot down by the Ohio National Guard during what was a peaceful demonstration. We wondered whether we'd go on with our show that night or had to go dark to pay tribute to them. We decided to perform. Crosby, Stills, and Nash eventually wrote about that incident. And as we leave you, I want to play their song.